KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the Excelsior.
West Portal.
Potrero Hill.
I'm from the Bayview.
Diamond Heights.
Inner Sunset.
Coming up, Richmond community members get involved with regulating their own air quality.
When I come home late at night, that's when they're kicking out their emissions. I don't know what's coming out them stacks. I just know when I get close to it, my eyes start burning.
Then we'll continue our series of interviews with candidates for San Francisco mayor.
I'm not saying Democratic people are bad, okay? Don't get me wrong. It's Democratic agenda who has been destroyed San Francisco.
Meet Ellen Zhao and how a Bay Area community helped overthrow a dictator thousands of miles away.
When we had no internet connection inside Sudan, Sudanese diaspora were actually the voices of Sudan.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. We hear a lot about bad air quality in California, and it's hard to know what we can do about it. But thanks to a 2017 law, communities in two Bay Area cities known for air pollution get to participate in setting their own air quality policies. The bill puts air pollution in the hands of the people. So what does community involvement in air policy really look like? Reporter Brett Simpson went to Richmond to find out.
It's a Wednesday night in September, and the Richmond Civic Center auditorium is packed. 32 people crowd around tables in the center of the room. Doctors sit next to NAACP members who sit next to oil industry representatives. This is the Richmond Air Quality Steering Committee, and they're meeting tonight to make an important decision. Community members who showed up to watch line the walls. That's where I find Lawrence Holiday, a 61-year-old basketball coach. He's here because he's sick of driving past the Chevron oil refinery.
I drive for Lyft sometimes. I drive limos sometimes. And that's what I notice when I come home late at night. That's when they're kicking out their emissions. I don't know what's coming out them stacks. I just know when I get close to it, my eyes start burning.
It's no secret that Richmond residents breathe bad air. The city's wedged between two refineries and two highways. It has some of the worst air pollution in the country, and a lot of its residents have health issues. Holiday rattles off all the people he knows who are sick.
One of my close friends just had pancreatic cancer surgery. His wife had double vasectomy. His son can't breathe. He had to move out of the city.
Holiday's sick of getting sick, and he wants solutions. Tonight, for the first time ever, the community gets a chance to provide them. In 2017, Governor Jerry Brown signed a landmark law, Assembly Bill 617. Under the bill, 10 communities with the state's worst air pollution are forming committees to help set new air policy. Everything from installing monitors on their own blocks to drafting plans to reduce emissions from polluters just down the street. This is hyper-local air quality regulation. At least, that's the idea. In the Bay Area, the state's elected West Oakland and Richmond. The communities get to vote, start regulating emissions now, or spend a year getting more air quality data first. West Oakland voted to jump straight into regulation, but it's a way smaller area than Richmond, and they've already collected a lot of data on their air quality. At this meeting tonight, Richmond's casting their vote.
I'm still making up my mind. I have a lot of questions.
Let's stay the course. Let's keep community involvement. Let's do this process correctly.
It's going on and on and on, and you know, delays and delays.
I think 7 decades of bad health outcomes is enough data.
The stakes are high. So what would a year of more data tell Richmond? I ventured down into the cold basement of UC Berkeley's chemistry building to ask an expert. Professor Ronald Cohen's been collecting Bay Area air quality data for years. Richmond has 10 air monitors, and Cohen runs 7 of them. They measure things like carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases, and particulates.
All things that contribute to air pollution and poor health.
Cohen is all about data collection. But he says that more data doesn't necessarily mean better data. Richmond's Air Quality Committee wants to install 100 monitors this year. To him, that sounds like a lot of work that might end up producing unreliable results.
So I would say make 10 really good ones instead of 100.
Cohen's not on the committee, but if they were asking, he'd say that installing lots of monitors really close together might just tell you what you could learn from a stroll around the neighborhood. Like, we already know that trucks emit carbon dioxide. So if there's a truck yard, why do we need to install air monitors around it to find that out?
We could have instead just had a camera and counted trucks, and is way less expensive than making measurements for a year.
Collecting more data also means waiting to regulate emissions. For some, the health costs of a year's delay feel personal. I meet committee member Dr. Rohan Radhakrishna at the West County Health Clinic.
Every morning, I see about 10 patients, and a few of them are going to have respiratory conditions.
Still, he believes in the power of getting better data.
Deeper data matters, and delay can cause more disease and disability. So we got to do both at the same time.
But tonight, at the meeting in Richmond, this new air quality committee has to choose one. Delay for data or regulate now. The committee voted...
The majority rules. Option one is what we'll move forward with.
And chose to delay.
So any reactions to the vote?
Yeah, it's stupid.
Andre Soto is the Richmond organizer at Communities for a Better Environment.
But then this committee is self-selected to be stacked with pro-industry people. So I'm not surprised at the outcome, but I'm disappointed. But the real problem here is Chevron. The real problem here is Sims Metals, all these industrial polluters. So, you know, this is all a charade.
Randy Joseph, engagement coordinator at the RISE Youth Council, thinks differently.
I don't know. Everybody just says Chevron, Chevron, Chevron. And if, for example, if you look at San Pablo, Chevron's not near San Pablo, right? But they have the same health issues.
Outcome aside, many saw the vote as a positive reflection of a community-driven process. Like Julia Walsh, volunteer at No Coal in Richmond.
I was delighted at the openness of the discussion, willingness to listen to everyone. And so I appreciate the process, even though it seems long and drawn out at times.
But Lawrence Holliday came to see his community produce results. And he left wondering whether their decision would change anything for Richmond at all.
Committees do a lot of talking, but don't have no resolve, you know, and no solution. You know, I wanted to ask the question was, how many people here are sick? How many people here are ill, are really affected by this? Monitoring is fine. Trying to resolve the emissions is fine. But the illnesses, what are they doing for the people that are ill? You know, the people that are actually sick.
Holliday wants to remind the committee they have an opportunity to take action for people like him. Will the new data make the delay worth it? We'll find out next year. In Richmond, I'm Brett Simpson for Cross Currents.
Brett is a student at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Ellen Lee Zhao is one of five candidates running to unseat San Francisco's current mayor. She's got a master's degree in social work from San Francisco State and has worked as a behavioral health clinician. She served as a union steward for San Francisco government employees and served two terms as a civil grand jury member. This is her second run for mayor. While all the candidates in the race for mayor are running without official party affiliation, Zhao rails against the, quote, monostate. That's what she calls the Democratic Party, which is prominent in San Francisco politics. She spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney.
When I become a mayor, I will target five problems that we are facing today. Number one, I will release the empty apartments by 282 programs that work with the tenants and also the property owners.
How would you get people to release the units that are unoccupied?
Oh, that is very easy. The mayor's office will guarantee no one will be sued if they come up and run their places to help the people in San Francisco.
I don't see how you could possibly protect them from being sued as the mayor.
I've talked to many of the legal, you know, people how we can create policies. We can, as a city, create a policy that's specifically to help the people in San Francisco needed housing. The most important thing that people will get housing, if they don't like the place, what they don't like, we can switch and do mediation and look for another location. But they will not be sued. If they chose to be suing, like let's say you have a corrupted lawyer, mm-hmm. They continue to corrupt the system, then if they want to sue, the San Francisco lawyer will be their team to sue. Hmm. Number two, I will end the free needles that has been killing people's quality of life. No drug abusers that I know of that they wanted to be in drug and be dead and be feeling sick on the street as homeless and no jobs. I spoke to people, they want three things: a job, away from drug, and a place to sleep. You talk to people on the street. And number three, I will work with the federal government to declare emergency when I get into the office so I can clear and save the homeless people from the politicians. The politician has been using the homeless people, the numbers of the homeless people, they drain the public system, the money. But the local people...
Wait, I don't understand what you just said. The city
allocates... The more homeless the city has, the more money the politician will get because they allocate the money from the public funds to nonprofits or to whatever the program they created related to them.
You're saying that the systems that are in place that purportedly are supposed to be helping homeless people are making people rich?
Yes. Homeless, it's become a politician political game for their own gang. The homeless will not get the money for the money it's allocated. In my experience as a public government worker, we've seen the more money we allocate for homeless, the more homeless the real increase.
Because nonprofits or SRO owners, those people are the ones who profit. That's
one of them. But the most important message is every time we house the homeless people, the other cities send them to San Francisco and tell other cities and say that we have all the resources. We give them free meals. We give them free medication and medical needs. We give them free housing.
Well, San Francisco also sends homeless people out on one-way bus tickets. That's part of the city policy as well.
Well, that's because if the people are tired in some of the issues that they're facing, because when you say that San Francisco welcome because we are a sanctuary city and we welcome all people, include criminal activities and felons, and when ICE comes, so we'll protect all people like that. The message
sanctuary city policy does not say that.
Yes, anyone, all people.
It's a matter of the ways in which they cooperate with the federal government.
The law, sanctuary city, welcomes all criminals and all anyone. It's welcome in San Francisco, and that put you and me in trouble.
Well, so you want to cooperate more with the federal government. You want them to help out with emergency services as well. You said that there were 5 points. So release houses, no free needles, the federal government, you'll
help
work
the
with,
homeless.
Yes. What are
declare.
The other two then?
And then we have the robberies, the crimes. We in San Francisco have so many crimes. 100 car break-in minimum a day, and many of them, they under-report. They don't even report anymore. It's because we are no longer having a faith that we do not... I personally know a lot of people, we don't trust the government anymore because the government keep raising tax, the people who are able to pay tax, but then the welfare people continue to be welfare. To me, it's abusing the welfare recipients and let them stay there instead of empower them to get away and be, you know, having a quality of life on their own. So when I become a mayor, I will be having a legal team to study what is illegal to San Francisco that is violate the people in America, that is including Proposition 47 and Sanctuary City. When they are un-American, when they violate the United States Constitution, I will be having the legal team to review them and then put back law and order to protect San Francisco.
I think that you mentioned the four main points.
Yes.
You went to robberies. What is the fifth one?
That is the most important thing. Government corruption.
Okay.
Yes. When I become a mayor, I will audit each department. We know San Francisco is crooked. Think about it. If we spend $3,900 to $17,000 a month per homeless that is allocated, then we should not be having people dying on the street. We should not be having people suffering on the street. We should not be having all the same nonprofits and many of them doing the same thing over and over. Who are they? What do they do? How do they do it? Who do they relate it to? And who are the boards for them? And I will check it out when I get into the office. I will be review each one of them and how they delinquent and how they corrupted and send them to appropriate departments. That is the legal team who I will be bringing in, because I obviously one person.
Yeah, no, it would take a whole team of people to help with that.
It take the whole San Francisco. I will.
That's mayoral candidate Ellen Lee Zhao. She spoke with KALW's news director, Ben Trefney, and that story was produced by Sarah Lai Sterland. We're covering all the candidates. You can hear who we've interviewed so far at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Last December in Sudan, people began a revolt against the brutal 30-year rule of dictator Omar al-Bashir. The world saw the protests live, many going blue for Sudan on their social media feeds. Sudanese around the world protested. In the Bay Area, there were protests in San Francisco and weekly rallies at Oakland's Lake Merritt. One of the first people to call for change in Sudan back in December is a 30-year-old doctor named Mohamed Naji Al-Assam. He co-founded a body called the Sudanese Professionals Association. They started organizing protests. He got jailed and beaten, but continued mobilizing masses through social media until the regime finally fell in April. Dr. Al-Assam recently visited the Bay Area to meet with local Sudanese about how they can help build up the country while living thousands of miles away. And he joined me in studio. Welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you for having me.
You know, the big question I get asked by my American colleagues here is, okay, your people overthrew the military, a military dictatorship, but there's still military right now. And it's confusing for people. It's been a point of criticism also, I think, as to why the new government includes military, and not just military, but people here in the Bay Area back in 2003, 2004, they were following the Darfur crisis. They were going out for Save Darfur protests. And so for the current regime to include someone like Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, of the Rapid Defense Forces, people here know that as the Janjaweed, it's confusing to people.
Okay, basically, our goal was to have a civilian-led government in Sudan. And by that, we mean a government that has all the executive power, that can do all the goals and demands and the plans to establish and to pave the way for a sustainable democracy that can come after 3 years. Mm. In Sudan, you cannot just simply take the military or the armed groups out of the equation. You can't just simply do that because they were in every and each part of the structural system in Sudan throughout the 30 years of al-Bashir regime. Mm-hmm. And it's not simple just to take them completely out of the way. Now we have a constitutional declaration that exactly entitled every and each job and every and each objective of each structure of the government, and with all the executive power under the hands and the control of the cabinet.
So this is March 30th, downtown San Francisco, mm-hmm. couple of miles mm-hmm. from here. Mm-hmm. Sudanese community in the Bay Area shut down San Francisco, downtown San Francisco, with the protests. Mm-hmm. When you're in Sudan and you see videos coming in from really all over the world,
yes.
How do you feel? Like, what is that to you?
The unity of the Sudanese people was the main factor in the success of all of this. The Sudanese diaspora, of course, in the US and all around the world, have played a huge role in supporting the Sudanese revolution physically and psychologically by every means, in the media, We all remember Blue for Sudan when we had no internet connection inside Sudan. Sudanese diaspora were actually the voices of Sudan, of what is going on in Sudan. So we have to stick to all of that to actually go through this very difficult 3 years and then beyond as well, because even the democracy itself will be very difficult, because it's a democracy after 33 decades of dictatorship. It will not be easy.
And what do you think the specific role of the diaspora can be? I mean, the Sudanese diaspora has been supporting, you know, with the protests, politically as well, people writing their congresspeople, people going to their congresspeople. I was walking outside of a San Francisco theater and there were stickers on the wall just in San Francisco, say, you know, stand with Sudan. And you're here to meet also with professionals. You're meeting, I think, with local doctors mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. engineers. So what role do you think diasporans can play? Are you here to convince people to go back or what?
Not actually convincing them to go back, but they can help in it in basically everything in Sudan. The civil service in Sudan is basically collapsed. Mm. We have the previous government has had no strategies, no plans, nothing at all. And we need to now reestablish or actually establish the plans and the different ways to lift the situation in Sudan and to build and to start putting Sudan in the track of change. Mm. And of course, the experiences of the Sudanese in the diaspora, as well as the Sudanese here in the US, of course, would be very helpful. And they are not waiting for me actually to say that to them. They have actually started doing that a long time ago. And from here, shout out to SAPA, Sudanese Association of Physicians here in the US. They have, from I believe April, started working with the other Sudanese associations of medical doctors inside Sudan and around the world. And now they have what we call SAHA. SAHA is the some sort of the policy of how to build and establish the whole health system in Sudan mm. from scratch.
How can you build trust? Because, you know, I can tell you some people would love to go back to Sudan and do a project, make some kind of thing, but there's a worry that I might go and start something in Sudan in this 3 years, and then what if something happens? How do you give people the confidence to, you know, go and start, you know, a startup, for example, in Khartoum?
Mm-hmm. So change is a process, and one of the things that we all should start doing is to practice this change and to actually start doing things. And of course, things will happen. Challenges will face this project of change. But you cannot know what are the challenges and what do we need to fix and what do we need to modify without actually practicing and starting doing things in Sudan. So now we have the government that Sudanese people we're all eager for. We have the rights in the Bill of Rights, in the Constitutional Declaration. We have the written papers ready, and we need to start practicing this change.
That was Sudanese doctor and activist Muhammad Najil Assam. You can listen to our full conversation at kalw.org. And while you're there, make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter. Get all the interviews and stories in your inbox every week. تفاهم تاني ما في تفاهم تاني ما في Tune in tomorrow at 5. Family liaisons have been part of San Francisco Unified for years, but But meeting family needs in a city of widening health gaps isn't easy.
And I always tell my families that, even in front of like the principal and stuff, I said, SFUSD pays me, but I work for y'all. I'll lose my job behind one of y'all before I lose my job behind one of them.
The original documentary, The Big Lift, Meeting Family Needs in High Poverty Schools, tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. And let's end the show with some local music.
From the forest comes a voice with the darkness comes a choice.
This is Maya from San Francisco. She's performing at the Starline Social Club in Oakland tomorrow night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Precious Green, Lisa Morehouse, True Gwynn, and Marissa Ortega Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.